Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This content is brought to you by Uphold, which is a great platform that makes crypto investing easy. You can buy, sell, trade, and earn cryptocurrencies on Uphold. They have 10 plus million users, over 200 plus cryptocurrencies, and they're available in 150 countries. I personally use this platform since 2017. They're one of my go-to exchanges. They also offer equities and precious metals that you can invest in. If you'd like to learn more about Uphold, please visit the link in the description. Welcome back to the Thinking Crypto Podcast, your home for cryptocurrency news and interviews. With me today is Roger Ver, who's a Bitcoin evangelist, angel investor, entrepreneur, and one of the very first investors in the crypto ecosystem. Roger, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me on today.
Roger, as I was mentioning before the recording, you are a crypto OG. I've been following you for years. You've invested in so many crypto companies. You've seen a lot of market cycles. And I have a lot of questions for you about what's happening in the crypto market now. But I also wanted to get to know you a bit better and your background. I've seen you talk about your experiences and in different interviews. But I want to start off with, for example, where you're from and where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in Silicon Valley and was around computers my whole life and ran a really popular for people that are old enough to even know what these things were. It was a BBS, that stands for Bulletin Board System. I think you're probably maybe too young to remember those firsthand, but they were really popular before the internet became popular and people would dial up with their modems and connect to other computers in the neighborhood. And it was a really fun time because you know, wow, everybody that was on the BBS lived somewhere in your neighborhood. It's not like we're on the internet. You have no idea where the other people are around the world. I grew up in Silicon Valley, but I'm talking with you today from Tokyo, Japan.
Now, clearly, you were into technology. Was there a technology job or career that you wanted to do when you were growing up? What was your ideal job?
So when I was really young, my ideal job was, and I'm dead serious about this, I really wanted to be a garbage man or a garbage truck driver. And the reason I wanted to do that is because you get to drive all over the neighborhood and talk to all sorts of people and see everything that's going on. And I used to wake up I forget which day of the week it was, Tuesday or Wednesday, when the garbage truck would come and I'd watch and they'd operate the big, giant, heavy machinery to do that. And to me as a young man, that seemed like a really, really exciting job. So and I still like, big machinery and heavy equipment and that sort of thing as well.
Well, it's so kind of, as far as machinery and technology, it's kind of serendipitous that you ended up with Bitcoin and the mining behind that and the tech revolution behind that.
Yeah, I think that was more of a outplay from my having been involved in e-commerce from the very earliest days. Like I got started in e-commerce before it was easy for people. There was no PayPal. It was almost impossible to be able to accept a credit card through your website. It was really difficult. The way almost everybody was doing e-commerce in the earliest days of the internet is they would literally have to go to the post office and buy a postal money order and then send that in the mail. And people today might not even know what a postal money order is. It's basically a check from the post office. You give the post office cash and they give you a check that's made out from the post office to whoever you want to fill it out to. And that way, when the person receives it, they know that it's not a fake check and it's not going to bounce because it's from the post office. And so people were literally sending those in the mail to buy things off the internet in the early days from independent merchants. And so every day when the mailman would come, it was like Christmas. I'd say, what checks or what postal money orders does he have in the mail for me today from people all over the country and occasionally from international people as well.
And the e-commerce site you're talking about, is that memorydealers.com? Was that?
it's what went on to become memorydealers.com eventually. And this is 1998 or something like that, 99, in really early days. And I remember when PayPal first came along, that seemed like an absolute miracle to wait. I can send money by email and I get, you know, at first it was $10 for every person I sign up. And then later it was $5 for every person I signed up. Like I made a bunch of money from, you know, referring people to PayPal. And then later on, there was another company called eGold, which was a fantastic idea. You could transfer around ownership of gold reserves electronically, but the gold physically stayed put in their various vaults. And it was starting to get more and more traction. And I was accepting it for payments on my website, my eBay sales. And then the U.S. government came in and seized all the gold because some of the users of eGold were using it for things the government didn't like. But all the normal people that were just using it for normal commerce got their gold seized as well. And so that became a real problem. And so then, I don't know, another decade or so went by. And then when Bitcoin came along, there was no doubt in my mind whatsoever that people were going to start using this for payments on the internet because it was better than PayPal. It was better than postal money orders. It was better than eGold because the Bitcoins can't be seized if you're holding them in a wallet in which you control. In the early days, that was just like taken for granted that everybody would hold their private keys and hold their own funds. Whereas more recently, that's kind of changed due to intentional congestion on Bitcoin and the high fees associated with that. Now, lots of people have been trusting their cryptocurrency with custodians, and we've seen, you know, in the early days, for people that have been around a long time, they'll remember Bitcoinica and then Mt. Gox. Yeah. And then, you know, there's been a whole bunch more ones recently, with the most recent one being FTX. But that just shows, don't let other people hold your cryptocurrency or you're going to be, you know, in for a bad time eventually. It might not happen tomorrow, but eventually, you know, bad things are going to happen. And that's why it's so important for cryptocurrencies to be usable in a way in which people can hold the cryptocurrencies themselves and not be dependent on a custodian to hold them for them. And that's been my mantra since day one, which is almost 12 years ago now since I've been involved in cryptocurrency. So time goes very quickly.
So what was your first encounter with Bitcoin? Did a friend tell you about it? Did you see it on a forum? What was that initial exposure to it? And what was your aha moment?
So the first exposure was in 2010, and it was mentioned on this radio show called Free Talk Live, just in passing. And I spent just maybe 1 minute, 2 minutes Googling it a little bit. And I thought, oh, this is kind of interesting. But, you know, with only spending, you know, a couple minutes on it, you can't really wrap your head around everything that's going on. I thought it's kind of interesting. Too bad nobody's using it. Nobody's using it. Move on. Next thing in my life. And then I heard about it again on that same radio show like a month or two later. And then I Googled it again. And that's when I put the pieces together in my mind that, wait a minute, the blockchain is this decentralized ledger that's not on any one computer. So that means governments can't go in and manipulate who owns which Bitcoins or block the payments or seize people's funds. This is going to change everything. People are going to absolutely use this for payments all over the world. And so I, you know, dove in headfirst and did everything I could to promote this to the world. And here we are, you know, 12 years later. And wow, it's become a real force around the world. Whereas back then, I would tell anybody that would listen to me, and I would even tell people that wouldn't listen to me about Bitcoin and what a big deal it was. Like if you met me from 2011 until, I don't know, 2015 or 16, there was zero chance you would not hear about Bitcoin from me in those days.
Now, I read that you bought Bitcoin under a dollar, if that's correct. So I have to ask, are you a Bitcoin billionaire? Are you one of the Bitcoin whales out there?
I've definitely done just fine in my Bitcoin and cryptocurrency holdings over the years there. So and I don't know if they were right around a dollar. So I'm pretty sure I got front run. Like I tried buying from multiple different places. In fact, my very first Bitcoin would be free. Gavin Andreessen had a faucet and he was giving away free Bitcoins. And I think I got a whole Bitcoin for free from that. But that's when they were worth, you know, maybe 20 cents or 10 cents or something like that. But thank you for Gavin for, you know, setting up that faucet. And then if you go and scroll back to my Facebook page from early 2011, you'll see I told anybody, post a Bitcoin address and I will send you, I don't know, $5, $10, or I think I gave away a whole Bitcoin in the early days, right? And you can see hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people posted their Bitcoin addresses, and I sent them all some Bitcoin in the early days. Wow. And because that was the name of the game, is to show people how this can work and how this is amazing and it can work for anybody all over the world.
Did you try to mine Bitcoin at any point?
I did. I tried mining some with my CPU right when, like, towards the very end of where I still had a chance of mining a block with my CPU, but I didn't actually get lucky enough. But then I did a lot of GPU mining. And then after that, there were some FPGAs, which I played with a little bit. And then I've done some ASIC mining over the years as well. But in the early days, it was easy to make money with mining because there wasn't so much competition and the price was just going up and up and up. Whereas now mining has really become a competitive business and you really have to be a specialized expert in the field to make money mining crypto. And especially at the moment, it's extra difficult because the price has pulled back a lot. That makes it really difficult for the miners around the world. And at this point, I'm glad that I'm not a cryptocurrency miner.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of miners have been facing a lot of pressure. Some had to file for bankruptcy, so it's a tough time. Now, before we go further into your crypto journey and investments and so forth, I want to talk about a period in your life where you were arrested for, I believe it was selling fireworks on eBay or something, and you went to jail. And I'm really fascinated by that because you bounced back, and I think that's a great story. And now, obviously, you're doing well. Can you tell us about that time in your life and how you were able to bounce back from those things?
Yeah, I guess the way I look at it in life, you only have two choices. You bounce back and you keep going as hard and fast as you possibly can, or you give up and die. And like giving up and dying doesn't sound like the right option there. So of course I had to keep going. And if anything, maybe it just motivated me a little bit more. Like I remember when, and for people that don't know the background, like the real reason I got arrested was for political statements I made in regards to the FBI and ATF being murderers in reference to murdering a bunch of kids in a church in Texas in the mid-90s. And they really didn't like the fact that I was saying that sort of thing. And I wound up being the only person in the entire nation to be arrested for selling these firecrackers without a license, even though the company I was buying them from and they were shipping them to me had no license. The manufacturer had no license. Cabela's Sporting Goods catalog was selling them with no license. Dozens of other companies were selling them across the country with no license. Yet I was the only person in the entire world to have ever been prosecuted for selling those without a license. And it kind of made me, of course I was mad, but one of the things that also really irked me is like, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I know I'm not stupid either. And in the pre-sentence report, which is this like report the government puts together to like give to the judge to tell them about what sort of person they think you are, they packed it with a whole bunch of lies. And I still, the guy talked about giving up and dying versus, going harder. This guy's probably dead and gone now because he was old back when this happened. But his name is Dr. James Missett. And he wrote this really nasty report about me saying that, that I overestimate what I can do. And basically just was a, I didn't appreciate his report one bit. And if anything, when I read his report that he gave to the judge, it just made me that much more motivated to go out there and do big things in the world. And I think at this point, I had definitely accomplished a few things here or there. But the whole system's rigged. Like once you're prosecuted, like they're just going to grind you through the gears. And all you can kind of do is hope you can get out as fast, do everything you can to get out as fast as you can. And then as soon as I was out, I tried to get as far away from that machine as I possibly can. I'm no longer a U.S. citizen. I'm not living in the U.S. I want nothing to do with their, wheels of injustice they have over there. But it's not just the U.S. either. It's any country. You really have to be careful just about anywhere in the world. If you speak out against the powers that be are going to come for you to shut you up.
So it seems like some retaliation there, and they were looking for whatever they could get you on. And
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, and even while I was in prison, the company that I was buying the firecrackers from was still selling them without a license. I mean, that tells you. And I sold, I sold a few thousand of them. This company was selling tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of them. So I was a small fish compared to this guy with no license. But the difference is they didn't run for political office and they didn't call the ATF and FBI a bunch of murderers. And if you want to get them pissed off at you, that's the way to do it. So
how did that happen with you running for political office? And I believe you're a libertarian. Is that correct?
Yeah, I guess the more recently the Libertarian Party has been a little bit better, but for a while the Libertarian Party wasn't very libertarian. So the word I prefer the most is voluntarist. And what a voluntarist is just somebody that thinks that all human interactions should be on a voluntary basis or not at all. And that's pretty much how everybody deals with everybody all the time. So for example, for this interview, you asked me, Roger, would you be willing to come and do an interview? And I said, yes, I will. And if you have a job, the employer says, would you be willing to come work here? And I'll pay you in exchange for that. And the employee says, yes, I will. And if you ask your friend to go to dinner, they have the option to say no. Everything's voluntary everywhere in life, with the exception being robbers, because when a robber robs you, you don't have a choice to say no. He's going to hurt you. Right. The other exception being rapists, because the difference between being raped and making love is just consent, right? If it's not voluntary, it's not making love, it's being raped. And then the only other exception in life that everybody just seems to be blind to just about all the time is government. Government interactions are not consensual. They're just like rapists and robbers in the sense that they're forcing their will upon you and you don't have the option to say no. And everybody knows that robbers and rapists are bad, horrible people, but everybody's been brainwashed from day one to think that it doesn't count when the government forces itself upon you in an involuntary manner. Whereas if a rapist forces himself upon you in an involuntary manner, we all know it's bad. And the real epiphany I had is somebody, you know, growing up in America, I knew it was, if there's a big war, they need to have a draft and they'll use that to defend the country. And like, I thought that was okay. And this man named Murray Rothbard, who wrote a bunch of amazing books, I recommend anybody pick up any of his books and it'll change your entire view of the world. But he pointed out that the military draft is the moral equivalent of kidnapping and slavery. And then I thought to myself, wait a minute, the draft is kidnapping and slavery. And if kidnapping and slavery is wrong, which we all know it is, people that claim they have the moral right to kidnap and enslave you, they're not the good guys. They're the bad guys. And that was the turning point in my view of the world when I realized, wait a minute, the U.S. government or any government that's forcing itself upon people involuntarily, they're not the good guys. They're the bad guys. And voluntarism is the word I like to use to describe that, because libertarianism, people might not know, oh, maybe it's just like a Republican that wants even lower taxes or a Democrat that wants more drugs to be legal or something like that. They don't know. But a voluntarist, I think, is a very clear description. All human interactions should be on a voluntary basis or not at all.
Not to get too into politics, but I do want to get your take on, you know, how do you think Bitcoin and even a blockchain, in a sense, could help solve and bring back the balance to the people, where it's not so much the government telling us what to do all the time and then they don't have any accountability, but maybe blockchain brings a more transparent and trustless world?
Yeah, that was the entire thing that attracted me so strongly to Bitcoin, is suddenly there's money that's beyond the reach of government control for the most part, right? And we need to make the technology even more hardened against government being able to interfere in what people are doing. And so that was the entire goal from day one, is to have a separation of money and state, right? Everybody today, for the most part, knows this separation of church and state wound up being a good thing. But we need to have a separation of money and state, in which people now get to choose which form of money they want to use in the market. Just like you can choose if you want to use, you know, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, like, or cash, right? It'll be nice when people can choose if they want to use, you know, US dollars, Australian dollars, Singapore dollars, Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, Cardano, Ripple, like, take your pick. Let's give people choice in the market, and people will naturally choose to use the services and the tools that are the most useful to them in their own lives. And I think, you know, anytime you have a monopoly, the quality of the product is poor and the customer service is poor, and oftentimes the expense of providing it is really, really high. Well, let's have an end to the monopoly in the issuance of money, and let's have some competition in the market. Just like it's great that we have Taco Bell and Burger King and McDonald's and Arby's all competing for food, let's have competition in the area of money, and that's going to lead to better money for everybody that works better for everybody all over the world. And so that's what cryptocurrencies are all about for me, and I'm looking forward to seeing even more of that take hold in around the world as the time goes by.
So I absolutely agree with you there, and maybe there is a historical change taking place with, you know, the birth of Bitcoin. But now we see the governments are taking the blockchain and tokenizing fiat currencies on it. And, you know, they're going to force people and inject it into the economy and say, you know, don't worry about this Bitcoin or Ethereum or XRP thing. Use this CBDC and maybe they'll give you yield on it. I don't know. But what are your thoughts on CBDCs and what the governments are doing now?
Yeah, if I can put on my conspiracy theory hat for a moment here, the most destructive thing governments could have possibly done to the adoption of cryptocurrencies around the world and Bitcoin around the world would be to allow the blocks to become full on Bitcoin. Because that, for the very first time in the entire history of Bitcoin, when the blocks became full, companies that used to accept Bitcoin for payments, companies like Microsoft and Expedia and, you know, Dell Computer, they stopped accepting Bitcoin. That was the first time in the entire history of Bitcoin in which there was negative adoption. And even to this very day, Expedia still didn't start accepting Bitcoin again, right? So like, that used to be my favorite go-to travel website and I could book everything with Bitcoin. They still don't to this very day. And if you read the press releases from these companies, like Steam put out a great press release. They specifically said the reason they stopped is because the blocks have become full And now the transactions are slow, expensive, and unreliable, and that's not usable for a payment network. And so I think it was governments that initially propagandized the people into thinking that having a block size limit of 1 megabyte on Bitcoin was good and somehow made Bitcoin more decentralized, when the truth was it was the exact opposite. And that gave governments more time to react and issue their central bank digital currencies. And now, you know, how much is Bitcoin used in commerce? Some, but nowhere near what it could have been if the fees hadn't gone to $50 and the transaction times hadn't become more than 2 weeks on average for a point in 2017. Like, it became absolutely unusable for e-commerce at this point. And that opened the door for all the governments to catch up and issue their central bank digital currencies and say, oh, don't worry about that Bitcoin or Ethereum or Cardano or any of that stuff. Look, here's our digital dollar. You can use that. And people don't realize, like, this also, even with like Tether and USDC, they can freeze your Tether and USDC on the blockchain as well, or your Binance USD as well. Like, don't think that that's permissionless. It's not one bit. It's convenient when it's working, but they can freeze it just like they freeze your bank account if they want to. Whereas real cryptocurrencies like, you know, Bitcoin Cash and others out there, the Moneros and Zcash and all the privacy coins I'm huge fans of, those are real cryptocurrencies. Whereas if you have the private keys yourself, nobody in the world can mess with your money. And that's a really, really big deal. But if you're having to use a custodian to hold your cryptocurrency, it's probably going to be the same custodian that's holding your central bank digital currency as well. And they're going to treat them just the same. They'll freeze whichever ones they want at any time, or do whatever they want, or loan it out, or spend it on margaritas without your permission, like we've seen happen recently. Like, hold your own cryptocurrency yourself, and you're going to have a much better time in the cryptocurrency ecosystem than if you let somebody else hold it for you.
So on the point of privacy coins, I am a believer in privacy coins, but I'm also worried the governments, and we've seen the, you know, narrative forming here, that they're putting a target on them, and there's been calls to ban them and so forth. Do you think they'll be able to successfully ban privacy coins?
They won't be able to successfully ban privacy coins, but another real visionary in the Bitcoin space was a guy named Mike Hearn, who was a professional capacity planner at Google and played a big role in the, you know, the block size scaling war. He was advocating for Bitcoin to be able to scale to be money for the world. But the point that he made, which I thought was just so, once he said it, it made so much sense, but I never heard anybody say it that clearly before. He said, even an outlaw can't use an outlaw currency. And what he meant by that is, if the currency is outlawed, even people that are doing illegal things, you can't use it, because you have to have enough legal transactions happening to be able to blend in with your illegal transactions. So if governments make, you know, and again, sometimes the Monero community, they get confused and think I'm attacking Monero. Like, I bought a bunch of Monero early on, and I'm one of the biggest Monero fans out there. But I see the writing on the wall. Like, I'm doing this call from here in Japan. Monero is already banned in Japan. No Japanese exchange is allowed to list Monero. Same thing next door in Korea. Same thing in Singapore. Same thing in lots of countries around the world. Privacy coins have been preemptively banned by governments around the world. It's not that I think privacy coins are bad. I think the governments are wrong for doing that, but sure, that's going to be a real hindrance to adoption. If you can't use it legally, only outlaws are going to be able to use it, but the outlaws won't want to use it because nobody else is using it. They won't be able to blend in with all the other commerce out there. So, and that's why I'm a real big fan of like privacy tools that sit on top of, you know, things like Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash. Like, Bitcoin Cash has this awesome tool called Cash Fusion that gives Bitcoin Cash a similar ballpark of privacy as a Monero, like in the same sort of ballpark. People don't realize it, but governments can't complain against it in the same way that they do with Monero, because it's turned on by default all the time with Monero, whereas Bitcoin Cash, you just have to use a wallet that has it enabled. And most people aren't aware of that.
So yeah, like, I'm not aware of that. And so it sounds like the solution you're saying, it's like a layer two app that helps with to achieve privacy is the way to go versus a true privacy coin, if I got that right.
My first choice would be for governments just to leave everybody alone and disappear and let people use whatever they want. But since that's not likely to happen, I think at this point it would be really hard for governments to ban Bitcoin and Bitcoin-based coins like Bitcoin Cash or any of these other ones. And if you can build really strong privacy on top of that, then it makes it extra hard for government to ban those, right? And so like Bitcoin used to have a fair number of privacy tools on top of it, but it kind of became real expensive and the fees became high to use it. So like things like Wasabi Wallet and different coin join things on Bitcoin. But if the fees are super high to use it, people aren't going to want to use it. Whereas Bitcoin Cash can still do those sorts of things for a fraction of a penny. But But if you look at the social media campaign, like everybody out there, they view Bitcoin Cash as some fake knockoff of Bitcoin, but they, most people probably don't realize Bitcoin Cash was razor close to being called Bitcoin and keeping the BTC ticker symbol. And the thing that's called BTC in Bitcoin today would have had some different name and some different ticker symbol. And if that had happened and Bitcoin had continued just working smoothly with super fast, cheap, reliable transactions, it wouldn't be $17,000 today. Maybe it would be $70,000 or $117,000 or maybe even $700,000 today, right? Like the adoption wouldn't have come to a screeching halt like it did, where everybody jumped ship to, you know, Ethereum projects or Bitcoin Cash projects or all these other projects out there in the world. People abandoned Bitcoin because it became unusable because of that block size limit. And again, with my conspiracy theory hat on, I think it was an intentional effort by governments to trick people into thinking that the 1 megabyte block size limit was a good thing for Bitcoin, when the reality is it delayed the adoption of cryptocurrency by around the world by, you know, a number of years, maybe even a decade plus. And it's a real shame that people were fooled into doing that, but it's a real shame that people are fooled into thinking that the military draft isn't kidnapping and slavery, and that government isn't organized violence without people's permission. Like, but brainwashing works. And a lot of people don't realize that there was a huge amount of censorship that went on in the Bitcoin community in order to achieve that. That was probably one of the biggest eye openers of my life. Like, censorship works. Wow, does it ever work? And I didn't fully appreciate just how effective censorship is. And that's why governments are, you know, trying to shut up Julian Assange and Edward Snowden. And that's why governments love to send people to, they call them public schools, but if you think about what they really are, they're mandatory youth propaganda camps where people for the first, you know, 18 years of their lives are fed the government line about what everything's supposed to be, and they're indoctrinated. By the time they're 18, if you're, you know, told your entire life, oh, society would fall apart without government, and we have to have a draft, we have to have taxes for this and that, and who would build the roads, that's it, right? You're already set in your way of thinking, and it's really, really hard to break out from that. And that's what happened with the cryptocurrency ecosystem. They used censorship to push a specific narrative, and then everybody that came to Bitcoin after that only heard that predominant narrative. And then that became the prevailing view. And that's what everybody believes, that, oh, the 1 megabyte block size limit was great for Bitcoin. Bcash is a knockoff scam. And like, that's what people believe. And really disappointing to have watched that happen right before my eyes.
So I want to go deeper there, because there's a lot of new people in the crypto market who haven't heard this story and don't know the details. They don't know much about the fork and what took place in 2017. And I want to talk about, what was the genesis of the fork, or the idea of that, and to split off? And I know it's based on the vision that Satoshi Nakamoto had and trying to achieve that vision. But what? Why was there a split? And I know you mentioned like your conspiracy, right? But what was the fundamental split there of people saying, no, we don't want to go this direction, and the other saying, and then, you know, you have your end saying, no, it has to be this way because it functions better and it achieves the vision of Satoshi Nakamoto?
Yeah, there were kind of two main, you know, I'm making broad generalizations here, but two main ideological camps here. One camp was that everybody should run a full node themselves and have the entire blockchain invalidate, you know, every transaction happening on the Bitcoin blockchain. And it doesn't matter if the overall throughput's not that big and if not that many people are able to use Bitcoin easily. The other camp, which I felt into, is that like it's and the first camp, they just seem to care about the total percentage of Bitcoin users that were running a full node. So if you have 100 Bitcoin users around the world and 100% of them, you know, 100 of them are using a full node, they're really happy with that. They feel, oh, we have, you know, full decentralization. Whereas my point of view is I want to have a billion people or 8 billion people using Bitcoin, but maybe, you know, the blocks are going to be a lot bigger because that's a lot of people using and a lot more transactions. So instead of having, you know, 8 billion people running a full node, maybe you'll have 8,000 or maybe even 80,000, right? Companies and people that are doing different things around the world with that. And so you'll have 8,000 full nodes or 80,000 full nodes around the world instead of, and that's, you know, just a very, very small percent of the users will be running a full node. But it's still a larger absolute number than if you just have 100 people using Bitcoin and 100 full nodes. And so that was kind of the disagreement, is like, what is it, the absolute number of full nodes around the world and mining full nodes, or is it the percentage of people running full nodes? And so if you limit the block size to 1 megabyte, it's much easier to have a much higher number of people running full nodes around the world that are using Bitcoin, but that limits the number of people that are using Bitcoin. And I was arguably the biggest Bitcoin evangelist in the entire world.
Right.
And I stopped using Bitcoin because it stopped being usable for payments. And I started using things like Ethereum and Bitcoin Cash and Monero and Dash and Zcash and a bunch of others out there, and just looking for something that would continue to work. And increasing the block size would have allowed Bitcoin to continue to work and wouldn't have hindered the adoption that was taking place all over the world. And but instead, my side of the argument, we lost. But I think we lost due to the censorship, right? Like, I think the other side really played dirty and did all sorts of dirty things and immoral things. But we took the higher ground, I think, on the big block side, but we lost for having taken the higher ground. And maybe the world's worse off because of it, right? We still don't have peer-to-peer electronic cash for the world that's easily accessible by everybody.
So on that note, for the new listeners, tell us why folks should use Bitcoin Cash versus Bitcoin. I know you touched on some of it, but if you could say, you know, here's 10 things why Bitcoin Cash is better than Bitcoin, whether it be speed, low transaction fees, and so forth, I would love for you to give that pitch.
Yeah, so I guess first I want to say people should use whatever coin is the most useful to them. And I think the majority of people out there in the world, I meet them all the time. I was in the airport 2 days ago. People in the airport recognize, oh, Bitcoin Cash, let's talk. And they know me, but I don't know them, but I'm nice to them and talk to them. But I told him, oh, there's a lot, you know, he was on his way to Tokyo. I said, there's lots of places you can spend your Bitcoin Cash in Tokyo. And he said, oh, no, I never spend my crypto. And I think that's the mentality, right? People just have it and they want to hold it and they want the number to go up because they're holding it and they hope everybody else will hold it too. But my point of view from day one and still today is like, when you spend something with crypto, when you buy something with crypto, take the dollars or yen or whatever currency that you normally would have used to buy that product and just buy more crypto. And that way there's just that much more crypto circulating in the ecosystem. But the vast majority of people don't see it that way. I remember the Winklevoss twins, when they were going to make an investment in a company that I had already made an investment in, I told them, hey, you should make the payment in Bitcoin. And it was like, I don't know, $200,000 or something like that. And this was when Bitcoins were cheap. I don't know, maybe Bitcoins were $15 or something like that. And they're like, no, we want to save our Bitcoin. We don't want to spend our Bitcoin. And I told them, I said, well, instead of sending a wire transfer to this guy to make the investment, why don't you send your wire transfer to the Bitcoin exchange and then buy the Bitcoins and then send the Bitcoins to that guy? And then there's that many, you know, more dollars worth of Bitcoin circulating in the Bitcoin ecosystem. But they didn't see it the same way. But that's still to this day, I think that's the way we make this peer-to-peer cash for the world. Everybody take the traditional money that they normally would use to, you know, buy bottles of water or whatever else, and then use that to buy cryptocurrency and then spend the cryptocurrency to buy the things that you want. But I think I got sidetracked from your initial question of why should people use Bitcoin Cash instead of Bitcoin. They should use whatever's the most useful to them. If you look at the hard data so far, and if you're, what's the most interest to you is just the number going up. Ethereum has been one of the best bets here for yeah. recent times. So has Monero, for that matter. And even BTC has outperformed Bitcoin Cash so far. But if you want to make payments and pay for things easily on the internet, wow, Bitcoin Cash is amazing. Grab the Bitcoin.com wallet, send and receive some Bitcoin Cash. You will be amazed. There's even a shareable link feature in there that's literally sharing the private key in a deep link that you can send to somebody, even if they don't have the wallet already. You can send it via text message, Telegram, Instagram, Facebook, anywhere and everywhere you can send a link, you can send somebody, even if they don't have the wallet already. And that's a feature built right into the Bitcoin.com wallet that you can't do on Bitcoin because the fees are high. Mm-hmm. Whereas Bitcoin Cash, the transactions are a fraction of a penny, basically instant, and work worldwide right now today. The big problem is it just doesn't have that cool brand awareness and brand recognition that Bitcoin does. And I think that's a real shame for the world.
So Roger, I absolutely appreciate your open-mindedness and your focus on utility versus the price and speculation and all that, because we're eventually going to get there. But I think a lot of people, even myself, sometimes struggle because we see the marketing, the branding behind Bitcoin. You know, they're now saying it's a store of value versus a payments network, and it's a gold, digital gold, right? But you know, when do you think? And this is a hard question. When do you think we'll hit that tipping point? Or what would be the catalyst to say, okay, all the speculation?
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. Chumba. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Stuff is to the side. How do we get real world application? And like to your point of people being able to transact and low fees and, you know, quick transaction speeds.
So I hope people listen to me carefully here, but Bitcoin BTC with 1 megabyte blocks will never, ever, ever be peer-to-peer electronic cash for the world. With or without Lightning Network, it doesn't matter because it doesn't have enough transactional throughput capacity, even with Lightning Network, to allow people to use it as peer-to-peer cash for the world. So the only way Bitcoin could ever become money that's used widely around the world is if everybody is using it with a custodian that's holding it for them. But then you're right back where we were with the dollars and people, you know, fractional reserve banking and funds disappearing and all the problems that we have. Whereas if you use a real cryptocurrency in which you can have the private keys yourself, and there's enough throughput capacity in which people can use it to transact on a daily basis with, now you can have real peer-to-peer cash for the world. And real peer-to-peer cash for the world is an incredibly important thing for the world because it increases the amount of economic freedom for people worldwide. Increasing the amount of economic freedom increases the rate of economic growth. And economic growth compounds year after year after year. And so even if you just have an additional, you know, 1 or 2% of additional worldwide economic growth per year, compound that after a couple of decades, wow, you've raised everybody's standard of living by a huge amount compared to what it otherwise would have been. And unfortunately, we're not getting to see that benefit because everybody's just busy speculating on the, you know, speculation of future speculators in regards to the price of Bitcoin that has no chance of becoming peer-to-peer cash for the world. And it's really disappointing to watch that happen.
Mm. What do you think about, you know, the ideology of Bitcoin maximalism? You know, there's guys like Saylor, Max Keiser, who are leading the charge here with that. And look, there's some lobbying happening in DC around that as well to make everything else a security and Bitcoin the only thing that's a commodity. You know, what are your thoughts around that?
I invite anybody to go and read Michael Saylor's Twitter stream for themselves. It's a bunch of techno babble without saying it's a bunch of, you know, wordy, cool sounding words that don't say anything. It's a Bitcoin is encrypted energy with protected by cyber hornets or something like yeah. That doesn't mean anything. It's just like marketing fluff. And so credit to him for being a good marketer. Like he's a good marketer, but like he doesn't say anything. Right. And the rumor I heard, I don't know if it's true. I heard it, you know, second or third hand here. I heard that up until a couple of years ago, he, you know, used to have big parties at some house he has in Florida. And the rumor I heard is that if anybody would even try and talk about Bitcoin at these parties up until, I don't know, 2017, he'd kick them out of his house and say, don't even mention that crap. So I think that just shows some closed-mindedness there to not even allow people to discuss something. And now suddenly he wants to become its biggest proponent. But if he was a real, you know, clever investor, he would have been, you know, promoting Ethereum or something else there since he got involved. He would have done a lot better holding Ethereum than BTC. Because, and the reason why is BTC does not work for payments. And that's what drove the original adoption without any doubt. That's what attracted the entrepreneurs. And now it's just a bunch of people that think they can pump the price of the asset and have it go up and sell it to future people for more, even though it doesn't have any underlying utility.
Hmm. So do you think that BTC maximalism ideology it seems like it's dying out. There's less Bitcoin maximalists around it. Do you think over time it will phase out?
I'm a little bit sympathetic to Bitcoin maximalism in the sense that Bitcoin had this giant first mover advantage in which in the early days, like nobody was using anything other than Bitcoin. It was Bitcoin and that was it. But that was, you know, 2011, 12, 13, you know, 14, up until around that point. And they squandered their entire first mover advantage, right? Bitcoin had 90-something percent market share in the world of cryptocurrencies. And because they allowed the blocks to become full and the user experience to become bad, now what's the market share of Bitcoin's total market? 30, 35%, 38%, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. Like, what a missed opportunity. And so, like, I think the only people that are Bitcoin maximalists today are the closed-minded people that are, you know, sticking their head in the sand and refusing to accept reality. Whereas I think I was ahead of the curve finding Bitcoin and telling people, hey, this is amazing. And I was ahead of the curve sounding the alarm bell that, hey, Bitcoin's on the wrong track here. If you limit the block size, you're going to limit its usefulness in commerce. And if you do that, you're destroying its entire first mover advantage. And the reason I fought so hard and so loudly about that were two reasons. I wanted the additional economic freedom for the world, but two, I was the owner of Bitcoin.com and a giant pile of Bitcoin. I wanted this to succeed and become money for the world. Whereas these other people that barely had two Bitcoins to rub together were out there, you know, making other, you know, videos complaining about, oh, we need to limit the block size and this and that. Like, hey, I had more skin in the game than just about anybody there.
Sure. I want to ask you about BSV and Craig Wright calling himself Satoshi. What are your thoughts on that? I think he's crazy, but, you know, that's my opinion.
So Craig has sued me, I don't know, four or five times now. He's lost, you know, three or four of those times now. There's still one lawsuit pending. I think Craig is a really, really compelling con man. He fooled me. He fooled a lot of other really smart people, but luckily he didn't fool me for forever. Mm-hmm. And on that point, his business partner, Calvin Ayer, this, you know, gambling billionaire Canadian guy, has he wants to pretend that it's a news website, but it's really just a propaganda website called CoinGeek.com. But if you think about what that website actually is, it's probably the first time in history anybody has literally spent millions of dollars of their own money promoting to the world the fact that they've been conned by a con man, right? So Calvin Ayer is promoting on CoinGeek that he's been conned by Craig Wright and that he's been fooled, and he's spending his own money to promote to the world that he's been conned by Craig Wright. So that's how I see it today. But I'm sympathetic because I was fooled at one point. Like, Craig is a very convincing con man. And I hope he doesn't sue me again for this. But if he does, I'll deal with it again. So, but because he's lost every single one of his lawsuits against me, had to pay me hundreds of thousands of British pounds and a bunch of dollars as well to recoup the legal fees for it. And he's just wasting his time. And actually, I'm really sad about it. The person that's funding all the lawsuits and organizing them, it's not Craig. It's Calvin Ayer. And so I wish both of them would just go move on in life and work on something productive. It's really sad to see them wasting so much time and money and energy and effort on that sort of thing.
For sure. So I want to talk to you about Bitcoin Cash and what's on the roadmap. I saw some news that it could become legal tender in St. Kitts in 2023. There was also some adoption via different apps. Can you tell us a bit about that? You know, what are you working on and what's on the roadmap?
Yeah, there's a lot of people, everyone's talking about El Salvador and the amount of Bitcoin adoption happening in El Salvador. Well, that was pushed from the top down, where everybody's using a custodial wallet where you don't even know if they actually have the Bitcoins or not. Sure. In St. Kitts, grassroots from the bottom up, natural adoption of Bitcoin Cash, where people are primarily using the Bitcoin.com wallet and this Bitcoin Cash Register app, which in every one of those instances, the users have the private keys themselves. Mm. And it just naturally happened to where now it's not a stretch to say that more merchants than not accept Bitcoin Cash in the country of St. Kitts. Like, more than 50% of the merchants in the business, grocery stores, gas stations, hotels, like taxi drivers, anybody, pretty much anybody in the country will be aware of it. And most people have already used it or are currently using it at this point. And it's really amazing. And the Prime Minister of St. Kitts just a couple of weeks ago announced that they intend to acknowledge it and recognize it as legal tender in the country by March of this coming year, right? That's 90 something days away now. And that's really, really soon here. And so I think that's a pretty big deal. But because it's not the cool coin that's in the media with a higher market cap that's orange color, it hasn't gotten nearly as much attention. The fact of the matter is the people are using it. And if you go to head over to map.bitcoin.com, you'll see there's an amazing amount of adoption, not just in St. Kitts, but in neighboring Antigua and St. Martin and just across quite a few places around the world. It's amazing. And if you ask the various payment processors which cryptocurrency works the best for payments, not necessarily the one that's being used the most, but the one that works the best, they'll tell you it's Bitcoin Cash. Bitcoin Cash works the best, but it doesn't have the cool name of Bitcoin behind it and the BTC ticker symbol. And so many people across the world, they're just fooled by, oh, I've heard of the Bitcoin name. I haven't heard of Bitcoin Cash. I recognize the orange coin. What's this green thing? And they don't look at the underlying characteristics. Bitcoin Cash is the Bitcoin from 2009 until like 2015. And the thing that's called Bitcoin today with the ticker symbol of BTC is some brand new project that's trying to be a settlement layer for the Lightning Network that still doesn't work and could never onboard the entire world anyhow because there's not enough block space to do that. At very best, it could onboard, you know, maybe 1% of the world. And that's not enough to become peer-to-peer cash for the world. So, yeah, look at the fundamental characteristics, not just the name.
I don't know if you can talk about this or share any data information. You know, are there plans to go to other countries, you know, whether it be in Europe or in Asia or even across Africa to push the adoption of Bitcoin Cash and make it legal tender?
There's lots of people doing that. The stuff, like everybody thinks that everything that happened in St. Kitts was because of me. I played a very, very small role in that. I had almost nothing to do with it. The vast majority of it was this guy named Sunny Gahani, who owns a bunch of liquor stores there, and he's importing and exporting liquor. And apparently he had like some, you know, lawsuits with liquor companies before as to which countries you're allowed to import and export to. And like, he saw the benefit of these international payments that you can make without permission, not having to beg a bank. And he just went crazy spreading Bitcoin to cash to every single one of his customers and all of his vendors. And now he's doing his entire payroll for all his locations and employees in Bitcoin Cash. And he's the one who really spread Bitcoin Cash, not just across St. Kitts, but a couple of other islands in the area there as well. Mm. And so it just takes one person with the right connections and the right motivation to make that sort of thing happen. And anybody can do it. And, you know, really check out the Bitcoin Cash Register app. In like 30 seconds, any physical store can be accepting Bitcoin Cash payments with no KYC, no terms of service. Nobody can block you. Nobody can turn it off. They can't, you know, stop your account if you donated money to Canadian truckers recently. Like, right. There's none of that. It just works, and it works for everybody in the entire world. And even if they kick it out of the app store, there's a web version as well at pos.cash. Mm-hmm. And like, nobody can stop that. Like, it's really, really a powerful tool for economic freedom around the world. And Bitcoin doesn't have those things anymore. You have to use a custodian for just about everything Bitcoin related. And if you're using a custodian, you've missed out on most of the benefits. And, you know, enjoy your fun time with whatever the next FTX happens to be when you're using a custodian. Like, don't use custodians. Hold your money yourselves.
Yeah, it's great advice. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later with FTX. But I need to circle back and talk to you about your crypto journey and then getting into investing in crypto companies. Because you were like a seed investor in the early days in like Ripple, Kraken, and so forth, Zcash as well. Can you tell us about that, you know, specifically Ripple and some of the other bigger companies?
Yeah, a lot of people sadly confused myself as being some sort of Bitcoin Cash maximalist. But no, I'm a peer-to-peer electronic cash or even any tool that enables more economic freedom around the world maximalist. That's what I want more of. And it's like I literally was the second person ever involved at Ripple. This guy named Jed McCaleb came up with the idea and reached out to me and says, hey, Roger, I see you're busy in the Bitcoin space trying to promote this as money for the world. I have an idea on how to do Bitcoin that doesn't require mining, so it'll use less electricity. Are you interested in supporting that? I said, sure, let's give it a try. And so like I, you know, put up the seed money to start Ripple. I was literally the second person ever involved. And it wasn't even called Ripple back then. The name of the coin, because we didn't have a name, was called New Coin. And that's what the folder on my computer for all the documents associated with that was literally called New Coin for years until I finally, you know, updated the name of the folder there. But all sorts of things out there as well. Anything that works. Kraken. A lot of people today know blockchain.com. Yeah. Blockchain.com used to be called blockchain.info. I was literally the second person ever involved there. There was the original founder who had just graduated from high school. And I reached out to him and I said, hey, I like this Bitcoin thing and I like what you're doing. Do you need some money? And he said, yeah, I should probably get a real server to run it on. Right now I'm running it on a Mac Mini in my mom's bedroom at home. And I said, okay, well, I'll help you get some money for a real server at a data center for this. And so I was literally the, you know, the second person ever involved at blockchain.com. And you know, put up the seed money for BitPay and a bunch of these other businesses out there because I want peer-to-peer cash for the world that enables more economic freedom for the world. And I don't care what the name of the coin is or what color it is, but I want it as quickly as possible for as many people as we possibly can. And so I want to help build the tools to enable that.
Now, how many crypto companies do you have in your portfolio to date?
I haven't counted, but probably, I don't know how many of them are still in existence, but the total number of investments is probably over 100 at this point.
Wow. And Roger, if you don't mind me asking, you know, the funds for all these investments come from your Bitcoin holdings, like, you know, being an early adopter of an investor of Bitcoin as well.
Some of it definitely came from that, but some of it came from, you know, money I earned in the Bitcoin field by running Bitcoin businesses. And then a lot of it, like when I first got involved in Bitcoin, I was the only person that had, you know, any money already, because I had my previous business, memory dealers. And so before Bitcoin had ever even been invented, I was already a multimillionaire. And so I had the money from that to start sprinkling in all these different Bitcoin businesses. And then when the price of Bitcoin went up, you know, I crossed the line from, you know, multimillionaire to the billionaire club. But that was later, right? But you know, even having a, when I first got involved in Bitcoin, the most established business that was accepting payments in Bitcoin was selling homemade socks made from alpaca wool. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? But that's not like a very big business or anything. Whereas, you know, my business already had, you know, millions of dollars in sales per year. I mean, we went out there and blasted it to the world that we're now accepting Bitcoin. And I put up the world's first billboard on the side of a Lawrence Expressway in Silicon Valley, saying we accept Bitcoin for payments, and advertising the computer parts we were selling. And that got worldwide media attention. From, you know, newspapers as far away as Germany were reporting on our billboard, and everybody was like, "You accept Bitcoin?" Like, they were shocked, and like, nobody paid us with it, but boy, did it work for the marketing front. And, you know, Silicon Valley is the right place to do a billboard like that.
So, Roger, what do you feel? This is a hard one, but what do you feel has been your best investment to date, and what was your worst?
There have been plenty of bad ones. You win some, you lose some. I think the worst investment I made is I didn't let other people hold my coins just for convenience of storage, but I've lent cryptocurrency to other people to try and earn interest. And I've had other people default on their repayment of that interest. And so that's probably been my biggest mistake or worst investment, is trying to earn interest on that. And I feel bad. I can't remember the guy's name, so I can't give him credit, but there's another YouTuber guy. He's like an Asian guy in Australia making YouTube videos. And he pointed out, if you're looking to invest your cryptocurrency, one website's offering 20% and the other website's offering 2%. If you're going to invest it at all, take the 2%. Don't take the 20%, because the 20% means there's way more risk, whereas the 2% means there's a lot less risk. And so I thought that was actually pretty darn good advice. So if you see real high, you know, rates of return, it's probably because there's real high rates of risk involved there. And so I thought that was real good advice. And I feel bad. I can't remember the guy's name, or I'd give his YouTube channel credit.
And I'm assuming your best investment maybe would be Bitcoin.
No, probably Kraken or blockchain.com, or maybe even maybe some of the other ones out there as well. Maybe Ripple. We'll see what happens when some of these companies have IPOs. One investment I regret not having made, and so Brian Armstrong, the founder of CEO of Coinbase, he literally begged me, like, you know, please, Roger, invest in us. Please, 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 please. And this is before they had gotten, you know, hardly any outside investment at all. So I probably could have invested in them in, I don't know, a couple $1 million valuation. And I kept telling them, no, people need to hold their own coins themselves. I want people to have their private keys themselves. I'm not trying to build another bank. And so, like, I only invested in businesses in which the users would have their private keys themselves. And at that point, mainly it was blockchain.info, later to become blockchain.com. In hindsight, I should have just invested in both, right? And then I would have done fantastic. My blockchain.com investment has done fantastic, but what an opportunity. I should have invested in both. And so that was maybe one of my biggest missed opportunities. And so, Brian, I should have listened to you. I'm sorry for that. But congratulations on your wonderful success. And thank you for helping spread this peer-to-peer cash to the world.
For sure. A question I have for you, and this is... It gets into the weeds. I don't even know if you recognize the name, because you're investing in so many companies, but a friend in the crypto industry wanted me to ask you, why did you invest in an XX network? I also know Ripple's Chris Larson is also invested in that. Does that ring a bell?
I invested quite a bit of money in that. David Chaum, like one of the deepest histories in the world of trying to make peer-to-peer cash for the world. He hasn't succeeded yet, but maybe, you know, maybe this time will be the one that does the trick. And so I'm cautiously optimistic and hopeful for that one as well. But it's been slow moving. I'd like to see things move faster, but I'm not the engineer building the system there. So I can only watch from the sidelines.
Sure. If you don't mind me asking it, and I'm just so curious, because, you know, you have amazing success. You're doing so many investments. Do you have a team, or are you kind of like a one man show, you know, or do you have a team of folks helping you with all these things?
Yeah, I have a whole family office that's a very competent group of people that help me with things.
Got it. Okay, let's talk about FTX and what's happening in the market now. I want to get like your raw thoughts and emotions and so forth on this. I'm pissed off about it. It's a mess. And there's a lot of congressional hearings happening. There's a lot of people angry at Sam Bankman-Fried saying he should be in jail and so forth. You know, what are your thoughts on this whole debacle?
Yeah. So I guess I need to preface it by saying, to be honest, I didn't follow it super closely. So maybe I don't have some of the deepest details, but the thing that just kind of seems the most ironic to me is that this guy, Sam Bankman-Fried, was basically the biggest loudmouth calling for more government regulation and more government control of all the crypto businesses. Yet he was the guy that failed to regulate his own business worse than just about anybody in the history of crypto. Yeah. Whereas most of the other CEOs of these crypto businesses are saying, hey, we don't need government regulation. Just leave us alone. The industry can regulate itself for the most part. So I find that very ironic that the guy that was calling for the most government regulation failed the worst to regulate his own business there. And then the, oh, there, somebody made a meme. Maybe I have it right here. But Sam Bankman-Fried is not in jail yet. And there, who did they already put in jail? There's some other crypto guy. The Tornado Cash guy is in jail, but Sam Bankman-Fried isn't. And actually, the thing I pulled up here, there's another NFT artist that made 4,253 ETH. He's been charged with money laundering. And I have a screenshot here. And then in the very next post on Reddit, in a different subreddit, it says the Pentagon admits it can't account for $2 trillion again. Right? So some guy earns a bunch of money. They charge him with money laundering, but the Pentagon loses $2 trillion with a T dollars again, right? Nothing happens, right?
So like I saw that meme, and then they were also highlighting that if you do anything over $600, the IRS needs to know, or you're going to be in trouble.
Luckily, I'm not an American living in America, so that yeah, no longer affects me. But I feel bad for all the Americans living in America. But if you ever, you know, if anyone's thinking of renouncing their U.S. citizenship, or if you just want to have a backup plan just in case, go and visit crypto passportsforcrypto.com or cryptoforpassports.com. I think I have both there. But that's a friend of mine's running that, and you can get citizenship. You can pay for the whole thing in crypto, and I think it's a really smart move to have a backup plan in terms of citizenship, because you never know when your country is going to go crazy, and it's nice to have a backup plan to be able to go somewhere else.
So Roger, you know, you've seen Web 1.0, you've seen Web 2.0, and what would be considered Web 3.0 now. And this situation, I think, I don't know if it's bigger than Mt. Gox or yeah, maybe it is, just because of the media.
In all terms, I think it's bigger. Yeah.
Do you think this sets the crypto market back maybe a couple of years or things like that?
I don't know. And it's a double-edged sword. Like, yeah, it's horrible that everybody lost a bunch of money and that, you know, crashed the whole market. But now the entire world is focused on cryptocurrency even more than before. And people are even more aware that, like, this is a real thing with real amounts of money and real things happening. And so that just would probably drive even more adoption and more attention and more things happening to it. But I think Mt. Gox, percentage-wise of the existing ecosystem, was probably a bigger deal than FTX, but total absolute number of dollars, FTX was probably a bigger deal. Sure. Both were bad, but both drew more attention to the ecosystem itself. So I don't know, just keep building out there and building useful tools for people to use, and then people are going to use them.
So one of the challenges here in the United States is crypto regulations and getting proper crypto regulations, because we don't want draconian regulations that stifles innovation. You have the SEC trying to put all altcoins into the securities basket. Bitcoin, for the most part, is, even the CFTC chair said it this morning, is a commodity. Ripple is being sued by the SEC over XRP. What are your thoughts on that? And what do you see as being the outcome in that lawsuit?
I think the SEC should be voluntarily funded. Whereas right now, people are forced to pay for the SEC, right? Ripple pays taxes that then go to the SEC for Ripple to harass them. I'm sorry, for the SEC to harass Ripple. That's crazy. It's like another example that a lot of people aren't aware of. So before I was involved in cryptocurrency, I was selling networking equipment. Cisco Systems was the brand of network equipment that I sold the most of. The NSA would literally intercept Cisco boxes, like Cisco routers and switches, and then install their spyware on them, and then finish shipping them and delivering them to the people so that they could spy on the telecom carriers that are using the Cisco equipment. And the NSA was doing that with money that Cisco was paying in taxes. So Cisco's making a product that people all over the world want. paying billions of dollars in taxes, and then the U.S. government then takes those taxes, gives that money to the NSA, then uses that to make it so that companies literally, they would rent secret like locations with different shipping addresses from the real business to order Cisco gear to have shipped to like the fake address so that the NSA wouldn't know that it's actually going to be used at, you know, AT&T or Pac Bell or somewhere else. So the NSA wouldn't intercept the gear and install their spyware on it. Like, that's how crazy the world is. So, like, these companies are forced to pay for the persecution or the disruption of their own business. And that's exactly what's going on with the SEC. I think a company like Consumer Reports, which is funded voluntarily, could do a much better job of warning people against, you know, FTX and other, you know, things that are about to blow up and have problems. And I think, you know, businesses in the market can provide the consumer reviews to help protect consumers far better than the SEC can do that sort of thing. So I would like to see the SEC voluntarily funded and turned into a private organization that interacts with other people on a voluntary basis rather than using tax dollars to threaten people with violence, right? If people don't obey them, they'll send men with guns to shut down the business. And I think that's not the way the world should work.
Tough question for you. Do you think Ripple is going to win this?
Yeah, I think Ripple will win. But if I can add to that, they'll win at the expense of, you know, maybe tens of millions of dollars, maybe $100 million plus spent on this. That's all money that they could have used to pay, you know, software engineers to build better tools to build on Ripple, or better user interfaces, or better wallets, or better, you know, user integrations with all these different things. So that's, you know, maybe $100 million of fees that went to not make the world a better place. And the world is that much less wealthy than it otherwise would have been. The world is poorer than it otherwise would have been. Fewer people have food to eat. More babies die at childbirth. Like, the Bitcoin maximalists love to make fun of me for saying that. But if you look at the countries with the highest rate of, you know, GDP, more babies survive childbirth, right? So if you want more babies to survive childbirth, you want more economic freedom that leads to more economic growth, and more economic growth leads to more babies surviving childbirth. And the way to do that is not having to spend hundreds of millions of dollars fighting the SEC with stupid lawsuits. And so I really would like to see a lot of that sort of thing come to an end.
And to your point, you know, like, BlockFi had to pay the SEC $100 million. I think they paid $70 million of that. Now they're in a hole. They've been trying to get bailouts and help, and part of that was from FTX, but, you know, after that collapse, that's off the table. So that's just an example of what you're talking about there. These companies have to hand over a ton of cash, and they can't survive.
Yeah. And it's not, and those are just some big public examples, but it's every single business and every person all over the world all the time. And like, a lot of people say, oh, you know, government's the price we need for civilization. But if you stop and take a step back and think about it, private businesses can survive without government. Government cannot survive without the private businesses. And so that means that the government is the parasite upon the private businesses, because private businesses can survive without the parasite. The parasite cannot survive without the host. And the host is you and I and everybody else in private industry.
Roger, you've seen so many things. You've been in the crypto market so early. Are you still excited about this technology? And hard question, where do you see the crypto market in 5 years?
Yeah, the two things I'm the most excited about are cryptocurrency enabling peer-to-peer electronic cash for the world, which increases the rate of economic growth for the world there. But then, like, artificial intelligence. Wow, what a big deal this is. And I'm surprised. Like, I keep, one of the most recent conversation topics I keep talking to other people about, and I'm surprised when they haven't heard of it yet. It's like 3 or 4 months ago, an engineer at Google quit Google and like violated his NDA with Google, talking about this chatbot they have at Google that he's claiming he thinks is like, you know, conscious and self-aware. And at first I was skeptical. I thought, okay, like, let's see. But if you read the chat logs with that thing makes a really compelling case. Like, I don't know if it's, you know, conscious or not, but like, it made a darn compelling case. And even to the point, like, I know I'm a human, you know, I'm around here. This chatbot, I forget what the points were now, but it had like these philosophical viewpoints that like really made me stop thinking, wow, I never thought of it that way before. And so like, if it's not there, if it's not conscious yet, it's not that far away. Like, it is coming really, really close there. I think Elon Musk's comment was like, yeah, well, can it drive a car? so which is a fair point from Elon there as well. But it's getting close, and that's going to change everything. And so one example of that is like, you know, most humans, if they put some time and effort into it, they can learn calculus, right? And they can figure out that if you give a dog brain, 1,000 years, a dog's brain simply is not capable of understanding calculus, even if you give it 1,000 years to study calculus. There's problems and concepts and ideas out there in the world that even if we give the human brain 1,000 years, our brain's just not capable of understanding that. But when we have these new AI super brains, they're going to be able to, you know, not just understand and recognize problems that we can't even be aware of as humans, they're going to be able to then solve it, and it's really off to the races. And so, like, I guess earlier I told you my philosophy is like a voluntarist, but actually maybe my real central core philosophy is an extropian. And an extropian is somebody who wants to increase the amount of intelligence in the universe. And I think the more intelligence there is out there in the universe, the more exciting, wonderful things that can happen. And I'm just excited and grateful to be a part of that journey and along for the ride there. And so I think AI is the really exciting next step to increase the amount of intelligence in the universe and doing all sorts of amazing things that my current brain isn't really even able to understand at this point.
Will it make crypto better, or could it be a threat to crypto?
No, it's going to make it better without any doubt. And if you think about it, like, an AI program can't open a PayPal account. It can't get a Visa card. It can't open a bank account. It's going to be using cryptocurrency for its payments because everybody needs to use money, including non-human entities on the internet.
Got it. Yeah. So Roger, I know we're up on time, but I got some wrap up questions for you here. Sure. First, rapid fire, favorite food.
Shabu shabu, I think, or maybe samgyeopsal if people know what that is. So one is a Japanese, like, hot pot. The other is a Korean barbecue, pork barbecue with kimchi. So
I love Korean barbecue. Favorite musician or band?
I'm kind of weird that way. I don't really listen to music.
What? No music at all?
Maybe Orbital, like that, for people that are old enough to remember those guys. Like, if I listen to music, I like electronic music.
Favorite movie?
Ex Machina. I don't know if I pronounced it right, but that is a really, really wild.
Well, that's exactly what you were just talking about, right? With AI and consciousness and so
that,
forth.
That could happen. Like, that's what makes, I like science fiction movies that are believable, that could actually, like, could potentially happen. And like that's a real head spinning movie. If you haven't seen it, even though it's a few years old, go out and get that one. It's awesome.
I love it. Yeah, I watch it. I've watched it maybe like 5 times. It's one of those like sci-fi movies. I'm into sci-fi, so I'll watch Blade Runner, Ex Machina, and all that. Favorite book?
For science fiction books, probably like I have to name a couple. The 2001, 2011, or 2063, I forget there. The 2001 series, right? There are 4 books in that series, were all fantastic. And then another one that was really excellent, I think, was Friday, is it? I think Robert Heinlein. The story plot is that there's a colony of humans on the moon, and the governments of Earth are trying to boss around the humans on the moon. And the humans on the moon are saying, like, hey, you're not the boss of us anymore. You stay on the Earth and do your stuff. We're on the moon and we'll do our stuff. And the Earth governments are saying, no, you better continue to obey us. And so what the people on the moon did is they used the Earth's gravity against them by dropping moon rocks as a weapon down onto the Earth to get the governments of the Earth to leave them alone on the moon. Is that Friday? I think the name of that book was Friday, or somebody else will know the name of that book. But that was another really fun book that I enjoyed a lot. And then I'm sorry, there's favorite books, and there was one other question.
When you're not doing anything crypto related, what are you doing for fun as a hobby?
Brazilian jiu-jitsu is my other hobby outside of crypto and books and nerdy stuff.
So if any of these Bitcoin maximalists try to mess with you, you can handle yourself, sounds like.
I feel pretty confident in any grappling match with somebody that's not a full-time grappling professional.
And finally, if you could create your own metaverse, what would the theme be?
I don't think I really have an answer for that. I feel like there's so much stuff happening in the world that we're in right now that I don't feel a real compelling need for a metaverse in my own life. There's so much happening already that that's something that's not actually as exciting for me.
Roger, pleasure chatting with you, man. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you too.